well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad that you are with me. Hopefully you had a good weekend. We are going to be talking with Rick Travis, Legislative Affairs Director for the California Rifle and Pistol Association, here in just a moment. California lawmakers are busy in Sacramento. And of course, you know, at the end of the session, rules don't apply, right? They kind of make it up as they go along in order to get their agenda through. And that's exactly what happened this past weekend. And AB 1127, which is the bill that would ban the sale of Glock handguns in the state of California, those few models that are available for sale right now, did pass out of the assembly. It is on its way to Governor Gavin Newsom's desk. We have heard, of course, from Gavin Newsom that he's not anti-gun, right? Just believes in a few common sense gun safety measures. So is banning the sale of the most popular, probably the most popular handgun in the country and in the state of California. Is that just a reasonable common sense measure? I guess we'll find out. And I have a feeling that, yes, it will be for Governor Newsom. So with that, let's get right to our conversation with Rick Travis of the California Rifle and Pistol Association. Rick, thanks very much for joining me on the program. I really appreciate your time, and hopefully you've had a little bit of sleep since the weekend.
A little bit.
Yeah. So we're going to get into I want to get into the details of AB 1127, but let's just talk about how this particular piece of sausage got made here, right? Because there was a legislative deadline, supposedly, for Friday night. Was that right? That was when the legislature was supposed to adjourn?
Yeah, so what normally happens, we have a two-year session, which makes us different from a lot of states. So we go through what would have been Friday night till midnight. They have to pass it. If they don't pass it, it's dead, which is always a good thing. And a lot of times we defeat some of these bills because they don't have enough votes to get across the line. And a lot of people are like, especially in the turmoil we're at as a country, I don't know if I want to vote that way, even though I'm a liberal Dem, because I got people that are watching. Mm-hmm. And so that's how we defeat a lot of these bills at the last minute. And what happened was we got to about 10 o'clock at night. Clock was rolling down. 1127 had not been passed, had not made it across the line. And they left and they came back. And kind of the irony is, if you go back 10 days before, California is infamous now nationwide that we had three bills passed with less than 10 minutes after they were amended that provided for Proposition 50, which is our redistricting boondoggle that's costing us $260 million when we're $82 billion in debt. And so this is where this was just salt when we had both Rivas in the assembly and McGuire in the Senate go, well, we need to be able to look at all these bills with at least 72 hours after they've been amended so we can understand them before we pass them.
Okay. This was less than 2 hours before the session is supposed to expire.
Yeah. And so what they did was, because this is the first year of the two-year session, there is a very thin, very thin, our lawyers have looked at it, it's thin, but there was a thin loophole that they expanded. They ran multiple trucks through and said, yep, we're going to go to 5 o'clock on Saturday to allow us to have that 72 hours of amended time to look at these bills, which was just extra time to twist arms, make negotiations to get bills across. So unfortunately, 1172 made it across the line with a lot of amendments and some hope.
All right. So let's talk about those amendments. I'm aware of a couple of them. I know that the deadline for when this kicks in has been moved, I believe, from January to July 1st of next year, right?
Yep.
I saw that there was also this amendment that, you know, says, well, if companies change their design, then as long as they're in compliance with, you know, other California laws, then these guns can stay on the roster. Which, the way I read this, and tell me if I'm wrong, Rick. So let's say Glock changes the design of Gen 3, right? Because Gen 4, Gen 5, they're not available for sale in California anyway. So let's say they change the design to comply with 1127. They're going to have to resubmit that to Cal DOJ. And Cal DOJ is going to consider that to be a new model of handgun, right? And so then they're going to deny the Gen 3 because it doesn't have all of the other safety features, right? Which is why Gen 4 and Gen 5 have been denied. So once they change even like the location of a screw, Cal DOJ says, well, that's a new model. And now you got to go. Now you actually have to comply, even if you were grandfathered in before. So this to me doesn't really seem like this to me seems like it provides lawmakers cover, but it doesn't actually give Glock the ability to change its design and stay on the roster.
Well, maybe.
Okay.
So here's what's happened. As you know, we've had several new firearms make it onto the roster. So the absolute part of you can't get a new gun on the firearm roster isn't true anymore. You can do it. So if Glock, and this is where it takes now in California, and this is sticky. I get it. So what I'm about to say is not against Glock or any other manufacturer. But, you know, for Californians, for us to get firearms, a company has to be willing to dedicate one or more lines of assembly to California to make it happen, which is a loss for them. I get that. So there is the option, the way this is set up, that between now and July, I'm talking with some of the people at DOJ, they understand the same way, attorneys, there is a narrow window that if Glock wanted to sit there and say, hey, we want to bring Gen 5 to California, we're willing to pay for the drop test, we're willing to pay for this, that the legislature left themselves that loophole, because one of the things we really pushed hard was the lawsuit that was coming. And this would be seen as just a gun grab. And there were several Democrats that weren't willing to vote for it, unless there was a narrow avenue that would allow a switch between the Model 3s and a later model that would not allow the Glock switch and would provide safety, which has been mine and my dear brother that we lost earlier this year, Sam Prentice's argument from day one on this bill of why it needed to go in the trash can. So now what where we're at today is, will Glock make those moves? Will the legislature hold to what they said? And we're going to see that. So the irony is, normally on a bill like this, I would look at you, Cam, and go, well, this part of the session's over, and now you get to talk to Chuck Michel and his people, because they're going to be suing on this.
Right.
And they're obviously, Chuck and the crew are working on an injunction on this. But at the same time, this is a little different dance with Chuck and I, because usually this is the handoff, and Chuck's like, well, you got to keep working on this and pushing on this, which we're doing. So not only did the session get extended, it didn't really end for people like me, because now we're doing some lobbying with both Glock and some other people to say, hey, if we can drive this through, this may be a good way to push back and open up the roster even further, because it could give us the excuse. So dark, yes, Cam, but there's also a possibility that we could exploit. And I'm hoping that we can get enough people to want to do that.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, again, I just want to make sure that I understand this correctly, because you're right. There have been some new models that have been put on the roster. And I guess it's now we're getting back into Chuck Michel's area of expertise, right?
Because right. I'm not a lawyer.
That's as a result of the Bolin versus Bonta lawsuit, where a judge actually put on hold the micro stamping requirement. And so that is no longer not currently in force, right?
Correct.
Right. Okay. But the loaded chamber indicator
still is.
And what's the other one? The magazine.
I'm brain farting this morning. Yeah, sorry.
I am too, because I don't have to worry about this, thankfully, in Virginia. But I guess the other question is, you know, are there other changes that Glock would have to make? Because again, Gen 3 is grandfathered in, right?
Right.
I don't think Glock has that loaded chamber.
I don't know.
So they'd still have to make some, as you say, not only would they have to come up with like a California only assembly line, they might have to make additional changes, even to Gen 5,
right,
in order to be available for sale. Okay. That's where you talk about this thin, narrow path.
Yeah.
Which is why Chuck and the legal team are also still working on what happens.
Yeah, because what this comes down to is, you know, the economics for any company. Like I said, I don't want to beat up on Glock. They have to look at the economics as it's worth it for them. And it also comes down for all of us in California. There are literally over 1 million people that own Glocks, and many of us own more than one, which effectively July 1st of next year, we can't transfer them, we can't do this, we can't do that. Like, there's a lot of thou shalt nots. So it's like, okay, what do we do? It's not like Gen 3 is a real popular in the other 49 states for obvious reasons, because there's later newer models. Right. So it really puts everybody in a really tough position. And, you know, that also gives opportunities for new bills of how to get rid of those guns that are not.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, I think most of us are aware of the amended magazine ban, right? Which I think is now in its fourth or fifth iteration since it was first passed in the late 80s. And of course, the latest iteration, which is the subject of a court challenge, the Supreme Court's going to get to a chance to consider Duncan versus Bonna later this fall. If that law is upheld in its entirety, then not only are quote unquote large capacity magazines not available for sale in California, but existing owners, those who had previously been grandfathered in, they've been told you can't possess them anymore, right? You either have to modify them so they can only hold 10 rounds. You got to destroy them. You got to get them out of state, turn them into law enforcement, whatever. You can't possess them anymore.
Right.
How concerned are you? I mean, this bill, you know, gun control advocates, I saw every town's press release. They're talking about, well, this doesn't impact existing owners. Seems to be like that's the natural follow up, right? I mean, if the stated concern is, well, it's too easy to turn these guns into machine guns, then why would you want these guns in the hands of lawful owners, right? I mean, are you concerned that there's going to be follow-up legislation that says you got
to get the follow-up legislation first? And I mean, I'm not in their heads. I try to be because for obvious reasons, but I think one of them is going to be when a firearm is outlawed, like the Glock in this case, then how does the state remove them from the populace so that they can't be accused of a gun grab when they're doing it? Because obviously, you know, at my age, I could be here another 30 years. I could be here 3 months. I've never found that expiration tag on me to know. And so as a result, you know, where does that firearm go? Because it can't go to my kids. It can't, like, the way they've cut that off, that familial transfer. And so as a result, I think that a bill like that could come out. Obviously, with the events of the last week, I think hunting rifles are going to come into play in California, which that's going to be a huge battle, and I'm prepping for that. So, you know, the bottom line is the left is not stopping one inch to come after it. And obviously, I'm very aware of these bills moved from California across the country, which is why I hate the rhetoric. It's just you stupid Californians. It's like, when is the rest of the country going to wake up and say, we've got to stop the stupidity in California, not ignore it? And when it comes to this, I really hope that people start to see the greater community. You know, I think it's so easy for us because if you're a hunter or you're a competitive shooter or you like to be tactical instead of tactical, I don't care. Those are all great things in our community. But one of the things that I've noticed this year, especially the last couple of months, me getting out to speak a little bit more than I had been, for the past year, going through some stuff, health concerns with my wife, is that the number of areas that I've walked into that are not normal for me, Cam, like, you know, I got called to talk to a group of people in a youth service organization and was blown away in a crowd of 500 that, had you asked me how many were gun owners going in, Cam, I would have said, maybe five, six, because it tended to lean in a very different direction. And over 300 people stood up.
Wow.
But none of them go to the places you and I normally go to.
Right.
And what I, because of that, was so shocking, I started challenging myself to go to other places that we normally don't go.
Yeah.
And that has rang true in all of them. There is a bigger crowd of people, but we're not connecting with them. And I think that answers the age-old question that you and I, brother, have talked about for well over a decade of, like, how do we get our community to the polls to vote? Well, we have to go to that community. And I think that's going to be a huge growth area of finding out. And so we have a huge program we've kicked off in California, largely motivated by Glock, was I noted on this bill, was that I noted how many women showed up at the Capitol versus men to help me fight this bill, because that's the first firearm they learned to fire on was a Glock. And so they're like, they're taking our gun. I mean, that's the women's viewpoint. They're taking their gun away from them. And no one was reaching out to them. You know, we've reached out to them to train them, but we haven't reached out to them to vote. That's 56% of the vote in any state.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we're doing that. So I think this is, the bad side of the bill is obvious, and I'm sure everybody's going to comment on all the bad things about it. The silver lining in the cloud is it has motivated and brought a group of people like other events this week together that I normally wouldn't have seen. And I think they may have finally stepped too far in the wrong direction and personalized this fight for a lot of people that weren't in the fight.
I hope so. And I hope that there's more attention that gets drawn to this, because I'll be honest with you. I mean, granted, again, it was a chaotic end to the weekend, but you know, I just did a news search earlier today, California Glock ban. And I mean, like the last news story I saw about it was a week old, right? There's been nothing that I've seen. A lot of stories about, you know, California banning masks for law enforcement. Nothing yet.
Right.
Of California banning what is probably the most, you know, popular pistol in the country. And I'm guessing California as well. So I think I expect that there will be some more media attention on this. I would certainly hope so. And again, hopefully that will awaken folks who, you know, may not be politically active right now, but when they realize, oh yeah, they are coming for my gun, hopefully that will get them involved. So what is the best way? I mean, if folks do want to get involved on a grassroots level with California Rifle and Pistol Association, how do they do it, Rick?
There's a couple of ways. They can obviously join and support us, donate at crpa.org, but they can even reach out to me personally at contact@crpa.org and go question for Rick or a message for Rick, and it comes right to my desk, and I will help plug them in. The thing I will finish, too, is you asked me earlier in the session, like you always do, like how's the voting changing in California? And I will tell you, I was really shocked. While this bill passed, it passed with less than what I thought it was going to pass. No, normally, you know, in the assembly, there's 80 seats, that's 80 votes. And in the past, there's been a lot that I didn't even want to answer your question because it was like, yeah, Cam, it was 70 to 10. Like, it was brutal.
Yeah.
This passed with only 44 votes.
Oh, wow.
So the line is not where I want it, but it's moving a lot closer.
Yeah.
Because there were many people that would not vote for it that were Democrats. And we picked up Republican seats. And so there is a shift, and it's demonstrable. And our board and Chuck and I were talking about that a lot yesterday, of like, we got to see several bills that the shift is definitely going away, and we were able to target those areas now. And so that's what we're going to continue to do. So the message to the rest of the country is never give up, never give ground, and always fight, because it does make a difference.
Absolutely. Real quick, Rick, is AB 1127, is that the only gun control bill that passed this weekend? Are there others that...
No, there are a couple others that we put veto requests in. Obviously, we had 1263, which was the ghost gun, which I hate. It was going after CNC machines and going after 3D printers and all that. That narrowly passed. And then the crazy bill, as I call it, we always have a crazy, stupid bill. And it is interesting. Gabriel, who's the author of 1127, his roommate in the Capitol is Berman, who brought us 1078, which is why there's so many close parallels. And 1078 was after the Nguyen v. Bonta victory that said, when the Ninth Circuit said, number one, you cannot put a limit on how many firearms people purchase in a given time frame, that's unconstitutional. The most liberal circuit court ruled that.
Right.
The state had the chance to appeal it to an en banc and didn't. Which that should tell you something right there. The governor and the attorney general, who love to do en bancs, I can't tell you how many en bancs we've been through at CRPA, said, no, we're not doing it. They're right. They backed off. Berman then runs, well, what about 3 and 30? He's trying, and him and I went at it, and he's like, he goes, at some point, the court's going to go, well, that's reasonable, and I'm going to find that number. And so to me, and it's why I've said this to people, you know, people laugh at it on our side and go, what an idiot. Mm-hmm. But anybody that's been a parent, a grandparent, an uncle knows that when a kid gets about junior high age-ish, they start the negotiation process, sometimes a little earlier, sometimes a little later, which is like, okay, well, if you said I have to do X, what if I do it on this day? What if I do it on that? Like, it's just a negotiation process. And a lot of times the kid wins because eventually mom and or dad is just like, okay, fine. If I agree to this term, will you just shut up about it so I don't have to deal with it?
Right.
That's exactly what the left tries to do. They try to look at the court and go, okay, if you said no to one, how about three? And I'm sure when we shoot down three, because we will, then they'll be, well, what about five? They're just trying to find what that level of acceptance is.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's AB 1078, you said, right? What's the bill that bans CNC?
1263.
And 1263.
Yep.
All right. Well, Rick, again, I appreciate all of your work there in Sacramento. God bless you for what you do. And I'm glad that you were able to join us on the program today. I know we'll be talking again in the near future. When are lawmakers back in
Sacramento? January 5th, they come back. The governor has 30 days from Saturday to sign things. So, like, we're still working on trying to get him to veto. We may get him to veto one of these. Mm-hmm. Who knows? He's been shocking on some other issues, so we'll see where he goes on it.
And he's making a big play to gun owners, right? Saying I'm not anti-Second Amendment, so we'll see just how hollow that promise was. In a couple of weeks.
So yeah, and then we have a couple of other fights that are coming up on the hunting side of the house in the next couple of months. And so yeah, it's going to be a busy season.
Yeah. And I want to, next time we have you on, I want to talk about, because you mentioned, you know, you think in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination that they're going to go after hunting rifles too. So I want to have you on and talk about that in the, in the near future as well.
Sounds great.
All right. Love to do it. Hey man, right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today and get some sleep, my friend.
Okay. God bless you, sir. All right.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
My thanks to Rick for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. We're going to be talking with Stephen Gutowski of the Reload on tomorrow's program, by the way. So I would encourage you to check that out. Right now, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there. Not really a true recidivist report, but it is a concerning headline out of Texas. 13-year-old boy accused of planning a school attack to serve probation in secured facility. Now, I guess that headline is a little weird to me, because how can you serve probation in a secured facility, right? Seems to me like you're not actually on probation if you're not allowed out. But even the fact that this is only going to go on for 2 years, I think is an issue given this the age of this individual, 13. And this wasn't one of those things where, you know, maybe he had said something to a classmate, but had no real plans. I mean, we've seen, you know, incidents where I don't think it's moved even into the planning stage, where individuals get arrested and charged with doing something like this, you know, planning an act of violence. Now, in this case, the 13-year-old actually did have a plan to commit a mass shooting at his middle school. According to WOAI in San Antonio, Texas, the teen previously accused of planning an attack in his middle school after reportedly researching mass violence incidents, including the Christchurch mosque attacks in New Zealand, as well as producing violent drawings, some depicting his school. He had been suspended, so apparently they were aware of this. He later attended an alternative school before returning to his regular campus in May of this year. And so that alone is a problem, because again, they had identified that this teen was troubled, right? Removed him from his school, placed him in an alternative school, brought him back. And then on the day of the planned attack, the teen showed up at school. He was wearing what was described as tactical gear and a mask before he ultimately fled the campus and evaded law enforcement before he was taken into custody. His mom, by the way, is also facing separate charges, accused of aiding the attack by helping her son amass that tactical gear, magazines, ammunition, accused of leaving firearms accessible to him in the home. She was also arrested last week after allegedly pointing a shotgun at a young child, though she has since posted bail in that case. According to WOAI, the teen will continue to receive counseling and other rehabilitation services while in the secured facility, with the goal of addressing underlying behavioral and mental health issues. Now, again, I don't have a problem with that. My problem is that how do we know that 2 years is going to be enough? I mean, what happens if 2 years goes by and the teen is still troubled? Authorities don't believe that he has been rehabilitated. I would, excuse me, I would prefer at this point, he's 13 years of age, he's been tried as a juvenile, right? So the most that they could hold him would be until he's 21. I'd prefer that, quite honestly. And if he has exhibited signs of rehabilitation, if you know, when he's 15, 16, 17 years old, authorities believe that he is no longer a threat to the community, okay, then release him. But the fact that there's only a two-year timeline, I don't feel confident that the authorities are going to be able to rehabilitate this teen in that short amount of time. And again, I'm also concerned about why he was allowed back in school. Why was he sent to an alternative school when there were threats of violence the first time around? Seems to me like the ball might have been dropped there. So, I mean, I hope this is going to be enough. But, you know, when we talk about getting serious about these types of incidents, okay, I'm glad that this was never moved beyond the planning stage. Glad they didn't carry out this attack. But, again, I'm not sure that we're taking this with the seriousness that it deserves there in the state of Texas. Now, today's Armed Citizen story from Washington State. Detectives say that shooting in Pierce County home was a case of self-defense. And this is a weird one, I will say, because it seems like the individual in question was known to the armed citizen. It doesn't sound like there was even any sort of dispute. I mean, honestly, it kind of sounds like there might have been a mental health issue going on with the person who ended up being shot. According to KIRO in Seattle, this happened just before 2 a.m. Sunday morning. Homeowner called 911, said that someone was banging at his back door trying to break in. When deputies in Pierce County, I guess this was in Spanaway, Washington, when deputies showed up, according to authorities, within minutes, quote unquote, they found a 36-year-old male on the back porch of that home that had suffered from a single gunshot wound. Deputy Carly Capetto says deputies attempted life-saving measures. Fire arrived, performed life-saving measures, but unfortunately that male did succumb to his injuries. Again, according to KIRO in Seattle, the man's mom identified him as Russell Terry, a father of five who was living with his grandmother who had moved to the neighborhood about 30 years ago. Caro describes him as a plumber who relatives say was deeply loved. Relatives said the two men knew each other, that their children had played together. Amir Hall, who's one of the neighbors, heard the gunshots. He said he thought it was fireworks. He said it sounded like a gun, but I didn't believe it. I'm like, not in this neighborhood. Other neighbors said that Terry was caught on their Ring cameras moments before the shooting, banging on their doors too. And Deputy Capetto says there's surveillance video that also supports the homeowner's accounts of what happened that morning. Homeowner not arrested. In fact, she said at this point, we're not looking at arresting the homeowner. This is being investigated as a case of self-defense. So, you know, again, you have to wonder, okay, so what led this guy, Mr. Terry, to start banging on his neighbor's doors at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then apparently to try to break in to this particular home. To me, again, that suggests maybe a mental health issue. And, you know, when we talk about mental health as a response to mass shootings, I know a lot of times gun control advocates say, you're just trying to deflect here. No, listen, we have a mental health crisis in this country. Every state of the union has a lack of mental health beds. And it's expensive to hire more mental health workers. It's expensive to build out those facilities. But we're not just talking about preventing individuals who are mentally ill from committing acts of violence. We're also talking about preventing individuals who are mentally ill from being the victims of violence because of their actions, right? Again, this appears to have been an entirely justified shooting. But did Mr. Terry need mental health help? Hopefully, we'll get some more light and more information on this particular shooting here in the future. Finally today, Our good deed of the day, here's the headline, heroic rescue, good Samaritan, deputy, save man from flash flood peril. This is from Green River, Utah. Local 12 reporting on this. It was over the weekend, Saturday afternoon. A man became trapped in a flash flood south of Green River. Emory County Dispatch got the call. Deputy Josh Opp, the first to arrive at the scene, immediately called for additional resources. Another deputy equipped with rope gear joined the effort. The Green River Fire Department, Green River City Public Works also mobilized to bring a front-end loader to help aid in the rescue. But a local resident, a guy named Kent Nelson, also showed up. He had a raft and offered his assistance. And so they were able to actually tie the raft to that front-end loader, then go out into the river to reach the individual who was stranded. They were able to put a life jacket on him. They successfully pulled him to safety. The rescue man described as not from the area, taken to a local hospital with minor injuries. Statement from the rescue team, they said the actions provided by these citizens were priceless. They put themselves in danger to rescue a perfect stranger. And so again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. All of those first responders, but also Kent Nelson, a good Samaritan in the area. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that's all the time we've got for you on this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. But don't forget to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. Keeping up to date on all of the latest segment news and information, including the repeated calls for gun control in the wake of the assassination of Charlie Kirk. The gun control lobby wasting no time to exploit Kirk's death to advance their anti-gun agenda. We've got the latest for you on that and more at BearingArms.com. We'll see you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. Be free.